Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Welcome to The Ugly Radio on the Pod Moth Network, a lo-fi sci-fi audio theater anthology series made for late nights and strong drinks. Join us monthly as we broadcast a pirate signal across time and space, featuring stories, songs, and frequencies from a rotating list of voice actors, writers, storytellers, and musicians. If you're looking for high-quality science fiction, skin-crawling horror, and other genre fiction, listen to The Ugly Radio on the Pod Moth Network, now available wherever you get your podcasts. The Ugly Radio. See you in the void.
Hey, Gemma.
Oh, hey, Lana.
What can we expect from this season of I Think My Fridge is Haunted?
I'm glad you asked, because I'll be covering the Great Plague of London, the worst husband in Australia, and the Salem Witch Trials.
And I'll be telling stories of the notorious Hellfire Club, glitches in the Matrix, and America's largest kidnapping case.
Join us for I Think My Fridge is Haunted, a very creepy podcast for very creepy people.
Find us on all major podcasting platforms, and now you can even watch our episodes on our YouTube channel.
Until then,
be creepy,
but don't be a creep.
Welcome back, everybody. What story do you have for us today, Mom?
Today, I'm going to be telling you about a serial killer. Another one that I had never heard of before, and I found a documentary about it on Hulu, and his nickname was the Torso Killer, and the documentary name I'll get into later, but it's pretty good and I would recommend it. So I'm going to be telling you about some not a nice person. Shocking. What are you going to be telling us about?
So as I alluded to at the end of yesterday's episode, I'm going to be talking about the Hexham Heads.
Hexham Heads. That sounds...
It's a weird story.
Okay. Well, and I look forward to that.
I have the Tom Collins or John Collins, if... There's two ways. It's the same drink, pretty much, just with different liquors. I chose this drink because I looked up England's most famous cocktails, and this was on there. So that's the only reason I picked it, to be fair.
Okay.
So whether it's a Jim or John Collins depends on one thing. If you're making a Tom Collins, it's with gin. If you're making a John Collins, it's with rum. So today I made a gin Collins, so 50 milliliters of gin, 25 milliliters of lemon juice, 25 milliliters of simple syrup, and top it off with chilled soda water. You can optionally use a strip of a lemon zest as a garnish if you'd like.
Okay.
So to make this, you just pour all the ingredients into a glass with ice, stir to combine, and top off with soda water. Ready to give it a try?
You made a Tom Collins with the gin?
Yeah.
I figured you would. So did I.
Mm. It's fine.
It tastes like medicine.
Kind of like a lemonade almost. That's because it's got gin in it.
I know. And it's soda water, which I don't like.
Mm. Yeah, it's very mediocre. It's kind of light. It's not too
bad. It is light. I think that if you wanted a refreshing, like, hot summer day, it's not heavy at all. But it just kind of lacks. It needs something for me.
Maybe some, like, grenadine in there might sugar it up for you.
Well, okay. I made mine with a little bit less soda water because I'm not a huge fan of soda water. And I thought if I just keep adding it, it's going to be really tart. Because to me, soda water is tart. And I like sweeter drinks. But I'm not a huge fan.
That's okay. It's not.
They don't all have to be winners.
Yeah. So let's get into these weird heads. In the small town of Hexham in Northumberland, England, something curious was uncovered in 1971. Two boys, Leslie and Colin Robinson, were having a typical summer day playing around in their backyard. The boys would often dig around in the yard and the garden looking for critters and crawlers, and this day was no exception. The boys were digging in the garden when they uncovered something super strange. They found a small, like a small stone, a little bit smaller than a tennis ball. Okay. This stone was crudely carved into the shape of a skull with a small nub of a neck, suggesting that they were originally connected to something bigger.
Oh.
Mesmerized by their discovery, the boys dug through the whole garden and found another stone just like the first. One stone was described as the boy. It had simple features and lines running from front to back resembling hair. The other one was described as the hag, having a beak-like nose and bulging eyes. And you should look these up while we're talking, Mom, because they're super freaky.
Okay.
I can't emphasize enough like how creepy these things look.
I'm going to go look right now.
I would not be taking these home, that's for sure.
Oh.
The boys took their new discovery inside to show their parents. The parents thought it was super cool and decided to put them up in the kitchen on a shelf.
What? Why would you put that anywhere in your house? That's gross.
I don't know. The family gathered in the dining room shortly after, and the sounds of glass crashing came from the kitchen.
Ooh.
The family walked into the kitchen to find a bottle had mysteriously broken, but the weird thing is, the bottle was originally on the other side of the room, and no one was in the kitchen when it broke. So it just flew across the kitchen and exploded.
I don't like it.
The family became super confused when one of the stones had moved locations. As well, like, now being several feet away from where it had been originally placed.
No. Uh-uh.
Yeah. That would have been my first sign to throw those things away.
Yep.
A few days later, the Robinsons' neighbors, the Dodds, experienced some strange things as well. One night, while the Dodds boy was sleeping, something grabbed him by his hair and pulled him halfway off the bed before letting go.
The dog or the kid?
The boy.
The boy.
Son. Yeah.
Got pulled by his hair. No.
Halfway off his bed.
And
when
where's
he looked back, nothing was there.
Is the head still, where's the head? In the room
this
with
is
him?
The neighbors. It's
a neighbor.
The neighbors are having ghost shit too. Yeah.
Okay.
He got the whole neighborhood haunted.
That's fucked up. That's fucked up.
Yeah.
I don't want to be punished for what my neighbor's doing. If they're bringing creepy carved heads into their house and having weird shit happen to them, that's one thing. But
yeah, do that on their own time.
To get me involved, no, we're having words, sir.
So the kid ran to his mother's room to explain what happened. This obviously freaked his mom out, so she struggled to fall asleep.
Later
that night, she heard something outside and saw a half-man, half-goat creature leaving the house.
Their house? No.
Yes.
Yuck.
Yeah.
Yuck.
After the Robinsons had become aware, so the people who first found it, after they became aware of what happened at their neighbor's house, they all agreed the head should be studied. The heads were given to Anne Ross, who was a scholar in the ancient Celtic artifacts. Shortly after Ross received the heads, she had her own experience.
Mm-hmm.
One night, she was woken up by a noise in her bedroom. When she opened her eyes, she saw a half-man, half-wolf creature leaving the room. So this time, it was a half-wolf, half-man instead of a goat.
Okay. Half anything, not great. But if I had to pick between the goat and the wolf, I'd 100% pick the wolf. Goats freak me the fuck out.
And the worst part is, like, you're thinking half, top half, bottom half. This, like, so I saw an illustration of it. It didn't, like, they don't obviously have any pictures of it or anything, but it was like, front half was like man body with a wolf head, and on the back half was like the rest of the man. It was like a backside of his, there's a face on the backside of his head, like that type.
Okay, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about, like, when you said
which half it was,
half wolf, no, I figured
front half, back half instead of.
Well, I wasn't thinking halves as in like front half, right half, left half, back half, or even top half, bottom. I was thinking more in the lines of like werewolf, you know?
Well, that is also got seen too, but we'll get into it.
Okay.
This, the one she saw was like, it was almost like transforming, if I.
Ooh.
Like
that's, like, it wasn't terrifying.
Like, it was like an amalgamation of man parts and wolf parts.
Ew.
Yeah.
Yucky.
Yeah.
Okay, which makes me think about the goat man. Was it like a centaur where like the bottom half was a goat and the top half was a man, or vice versa? Or again, is it like front and back? Right and left.
I didn't see any illustrations of it, but if I had to assume, it'd probably be similar to the Wolfman.
Where it's transforming. Oh, I'm so uncomfortable.
She followed it around her house before the creature disappeared behind a corner. But this wasn't the last time the creature was seen in her house. A few days later, her daughter was coming home from school when she walked inside and saw the half-wolf, half-man thing jump from the stairs into a hallway where it disappeared. Yeah. Curious about this, Ross decided to dive into the heads. She locked herself into her study and began examining the heads. As she was doing this, she heard some noises outside and figured her daughter was just playing. But moments later, the door to her study slammed open. Ross jumped and turned around, expecting her daughter to be there. But instead, the doorway was filled with a shadowy figure, and the room got extra cold.
No. She needs to get rid of these stones. Everybody needs to chuck them in the ocean. Bye-bye, stones.
So obviously freaked out by this, Ross decided to get rid of the heads before conducting her research.
Okay.
So she's like, I don't need to figure this out. I'm just going to give it to another expert.
Okay. So she's decided she's not researching them anymore.
Yeah, she wants to, but she's like, I can't put my daughter through this. There's obviously something wrong with these heads.
Okay, well, at least she put those two things together.
So the heads changed hands between experts, which, having similar experiences, ended up giving it to someone else to study. So this sounds like everyone who got it was like, I don't want this anymore. It's not worth figuring out what the mystery is.
So did they tell each other, like, hey,
that's a good question.
I got this creepy shit and bad, icky stuff is happening. I can't have it, but I want you to research it. Or do you think that they were like, I got this, I came across this super cool thing. I don't have time to research it. So could you look into it and don't mention goat men or werewolves?
It's like there's a skit where, God, I can't remember what show it was, but there's a skit where a lady drops off her kids at a firehouse and like it immediately cuts to them dropping the baby off at a different firehouse. It's probably just like,
oh yeah,
exchanging the baby.
Yes. Oh, I don't like it.
Okay. So a man named Desmond Craigie, who claimed to be the creator of the heads. His story was that he made 3 heads for fun to give to his daughter and made them from stone and mortar about 16 years before they were discovered. He was asked to recreate the heads, but his versions weren't similar enough to determine if he had originally made them. So I think people looked at him and it's like, the material's not the same. It doesn't really look the same. It just didn't look right.
So are they like, maybe you'll get into this, but are they like poured cement and then carved, or is it a random stone that's carved?
So the last known locations of the heads were in the hands of Professor Dearman, who concluded that they were molded rather than carved from stone. However, he could not scientifically date them.
Okay.
So, like, right after that was kind of announced, they made their way to a psychic who eventually lost them. So now the heads are lost again. It's probably like, fuck, I can't keep having this wolf thing come around and just threw them into the river.
Right, yeah. And then, quote unquote, lost them.
Yeah.
I'd lose them too. 100%. I'd lose them too. If there's weird creatures.
If you didn't have any haunting
things
and then you brought something weird like that into your house and then you have hauntings after that, just get rid of it.
Yeah.
Or document it. Like,
yeah. Although, I mean, if it were me, I don't know if I would immediately attach the two things together. Depends on how
you wouldn't
creepy.
You pull those
and
creepy
icky
fucking stone rock things in. And which it starts happening and you don't compare the two?
I don't know. I don't know. It depends on if I, maybe.
That's like bringing a creepy doll into your house and then it starts walking around. It's like,
okay, good point.
It's not the creepy doll.
Good point. I was thinking
those
like
creepy
just
looking.
Weird, nonchalant, like, or, you know, nothing like of any importance. Like, oh, I brought home a new pair of shoes, and then all of a sudden I wouldn't attach anything weird happening to the shoes that I brought in, but okay, these are creepy, so yeah.
They look like some weird, like, ancient culture
they
burial
do
thing. Like,
they
like
definitely
ancient native burial ground type shit.
I mean, if they were found somewhere else, I don't know that
the
I
fact
would
that they made it into the garden, that's weird.
Yeah, like, I kind of,
I'm assuming a garden that's been like tilled and covered in mulch and shit like that.
Right. I wonder too, like the guy that claims that he created them, mm-hmm. does he have an explanation for why they ended up in the backyard of this family? Like, did he used
so
to
he
live
said that
there?
He threw them away and they kind of just made their way there somehow.
He threw them away because they haunted him. And he was tired of Goatman knocking on his door and pulling his kid out of its bed.
Yeah.
No. No.
Super weird.
It is super weird. I've never even heard of this before.
Me either.
It does kind of look like something that you would find. I would kind of think like maybe Aztec. Looking at
it
the one.
It does look very like Aztec-esque.
Yeah. I would think like Central America or even South America, something along those lines. And I wouldn't necessarily think it was bad. But then if shit started flying around my house, I would think it's bad. And if a goat man and a werewolf man showed up in my door, I would think, yeah, that's not okay.
That one with the pointy nose is just gross.
It is weird. It is weird. I'm looking at a picture where they're different colors too. But then in another picture where a guy is holding them up, they're not different colors. So, I don't know.
I don't know either.
Hmm.
It looks, probably, the black and white photos probably contribute to how creepy they look.
Good point. Yeah. Good point. Well, would you like me to tell you a creepy story about an actual human who you could also say is half a monster? Oh, this guy. So I found another, to me, it's a lesser known serial killer because I had never heard of him before and hadn't heard his name, but he's pretty prolific. But part of it, though, like his, how many victims he has, nobody knows. I don't even know if this fucker knows. But a lot of the details and the numbers haven't come out until recently. So that might be why he's one of the lesser known serial killers. So this guy, you know, as many serial killers do, they often love to brag about their victims and take responsibility for lots of crimes, including ones they didn't commit. Some serial killers, though, keep their secrets under wraps and don't tell details very often. Oftentimes, relationships between law enforcement and criminals is adversarial, with the investigators trying to get details that the criminal just continually denies. So they'll come at him and go, "You did this." And they're like, "Nah, I didn't do that, whatever." This story has a little bit of all of those scenarios. I'm going to be telling you about a serial killer who developed a sort of friendship with the man investigating him for years. The investigator established a relationship with an inmate who he believed had committed many unsolved murders, and he spent years, absolute years, long time, getting the man to tell his stories. This led to several families finally getting some answers about what happened to their loved ones. The inmate in question is Richard Cottingham, and he was given the nickname the Torso Killer. Going back to the beginning, as we know, it's definitely not, but he didn't do the thing that gave him the nickname to everyone. So maybe that's why, you know, it was only a few torsos that were littered in here and there. But as we normally do, we go back to the beginning. Richard Cottingham was born November 25th, 1946 in New York City. He was the oldest of four children. His family moved to New Jersey, where he lived much of his younger life. As an adult, he worked for various insurance companies in different positions. He married his wife in 1970, and the couple eventually had three children. For many years, he seemed to be living a normal life with his family and job, but the truth was much different, of course. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about this dirtbag. The depths of the truth wasn't known for decades and likely might not ever be known, just to how bad this guy was. He wasn't completely unknown to law enforcement, and he had a few arrests in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but he didn't have any severe punishment for his crimes until 1980. So he had like various like DUI, robbery charges, assault, things like that, but nothing massive was ever attached to him until 1980. In 1980, he became very well known to law enforcement with the crimes that he had committed in the previous few years. In the early morning hours of May 22nd, 1980, police were called to the Hasbrook Heights Quality Inn for a disturbance. A woman in one of the hotel rooms was screaming loudly. When police arrived, they saw a man exiting the room and stopped him. This was Richard Cottingham. In his possession, he had handcuffs, weapons, a bunch of prescription pills, slave collars, and a leather gag. The woman in the room was Leslie Ann O'Dell. She was a sex worker who Cottingham had brought to the hotel and proceeded to restrain and torture. I'm not going to go into the details of the torture because it was not good. She did survive, but, you know, he tortured her. Let's leave it there. For this incident, he was arrested for kidnapping, attempted murder, aggravated assault, multiple sex assault charges, possession of a weapon, and possession of controlled substances. That was the pills that he was packing around. He went on trial for this incident and several other additional ones in 1981. He was ultimately convicted of the kidnapping and non-fatal assaults regarding three different women dating from 1978 to 1980. So there were a couple of other women that he physically assaulted, including this one that was found in the hotel. So when they published that they had arrested him, a couple other women came forward and said, he did bad things to me. Those were the non-fatal assaults that he was convicted of. But his crimes against women definitely didn't start in 1978. In fact, there was an unsolved murder of Marianne Carr in 1977. Marianne's body was found in the parking lot of the same Quality Inn that Cottingham was arrested in 3 years later. She had been physically and sexually assaulted before her death. She had bruising on her wrists and ankles from handcuffs. She had also had tape adhesive around her mouth. Law enforcement looked at Cottingham for this murder after arresting him for the assault in the same hotel. Basically, because they were like, she's got similar things that had happened to her. It's the same hotel. So, of course, there's
suspicion.
Right. They're linking them together. And he was charged with her murder and convicted in 1982. This hotel had another unsolved murder. Because again, this guy used the same hotel. That had occurred just a couple of weeks before Cottingham was arrested for the assault against Leslie Ann O'Dell. This victim was named Valerie Ann Street, and her body was found under the bed in one of the rooms. She had multiple bite marks across her body, as well as knife wounds, ligature marks on her throat, handcuffs on her wrist, and tape remnants around her mouth. Cottingham had also left a fingerprint on part of the handcuffs. He was convicted for her murder in 1981. So that's two murder victims, and then the assault, all at this one hotel. New York City is not very far away from New Jersey, and the crimes Cottingham was committing there, he was also, you know, New Jersey, New York, he's spreading it all around, and he's doing bad things in New York as well. In fact, in 1984, he stood trial for three separate murders that took place in New York City. Two victims, Dee Dee Gudarzi and an unidentified female, were found together in a motel room in December 1979. initially the fire department was called in on this incident because smoke was coming from the room. When firefighters responded to extinguish the fire, they found the deceased bodies inside the room. The women were naked and in separate beds. Both had been brutalized and mutilated, with their heads and hands being removed. This is what earned him the monikers the Torso Killer. And also he was called the Times Square Ripper because of the things that he was doing. So,
Jesus.
An autopsy showed that both women had been sexually assaulted and tortured for days before their deaths. So he's not a nice guy. In another NYC hotel, the mutilated body of a woman was found in May 1980. This was Marianne Jean Rayner. She had been cut across the neck and both breasts had been removed, cut from her body. So he's torturing, he's mutilating, he's doing horrible things. He also set this one on fire. So apparently he, in New York City, he's trying to get rid of his evidence by setting them on fire. But he didn't do that in New Jersey. I don't know why. I think basically he was trying to change his MO so that it didn't look like one person was doing it all. And he did kind of discuss this in the events that would come later. So Cottingham was convicted of these murders in 1984, but he didn't admit to the killings until 2009. Meaning he was convicted, but he kept saying, I didn't do these. No, it wasn't me. He denied his involvement in all of the murders, even the ones he'd been convicted of, for years. But when he established this relationship with the investigator, he started admitting to some of them. And then later, he also admitted to some things with a reporter who was writing a book. That would change when he met an investigator tasked with solving several cold cases in Bergen County, New Jersey. The investigator was Robert Anzalotti. He met Cottingham in 2003 and believed Cottingham was likely involved in at least one of the cold cases from 1960s and 70s that he was researching. So he got assigned, like, I think it was like 10 or 12 unsolved cold cases. And he thought Cottingham was involved. So he decided he was going to go meet this guy. Guy's in prison. He's not getting out because he's got these other five murders that he's been convicted of. He's not going anywhere. So he figured, I'll just go meet him and start talking to him and maybe he'll start telling me shit. He met Cottingham in 2003. He believed Cottingham was likely involved in at least one of the cold cases from the 60s and 70s that he was researching. I think I said that already. I don't know. I'll say it again. Cottingham and Anzalotti met on a regular basis for years, establishing a sort of relationship where Cottingham would deny involvement, but then tell details of some of his crimes. Cottingham claimed that he didn't want his family to know about the additional crimes, so either asked for the case to have no press coverage and sometimes asked that he not be prosecuted for the crime, because his story was, my kids have been through enough, because he has kids. My kids and my family have been through enough with, you know, hearing about these horrible things that I'm in prison for, and I don't want to add to that. And the investigator's like, but what do you have to lose to just bring some resolution to these families? So he started giving some details occasionally. Anzalotti was motivated to solve these cold cases, so he tried getting Cottingham to give as many details as possible. It became a cat and mouse game between the two, with Cottingham often denying his involvement or giving details in a hypothetical situation. He would later then give identifying details that would allow Anzalotti to cross another case off the list. Anzalotti requested the help.
It sounds like Silence of the Lambs almost.
Kind of, yeah. Anzalotti requested the help of the victims' families when he notified them of the case closure. He requested that they not give any details to the press or non-family members. Basically, because Cottingham was saying he didn't want his family to know about it or he didn't want to be prosecuted, that meant that, you know, the families of these victims, Anzalotti, the investigator, was like, can you please just don't go running out and telling everybody that it's been solved and that we've got the guy, because we want him to give more details about other crimes and admit to other crimes so we can get resolution for other families. And for the most part, that worked. The family members and of these victims were like, okay, we get it. We're just gonna, you know, because this is decades later that they're finally getting some resolution. So this worked for a few years until Cottingham himself gave an interview and admitted to several of his crimes. The relationship between investigator and the criminal continued for two full decades, even after Anzalotti retired from the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office. Over the period of time, Cottingham admitted to several murders that he had not been previously considered for. He didn't confess in any chronological order and sometimes only gave details based on the girl or the woman's appearance. And I say girl because some of them were teenagers that he picked up on the side of the road. Sometimes he gave him information about where he picked up the victim or where he deposited her body. The details he did give were enough to identify specific victims and link him to those cases. Through the conversations, Cottingham admitted to an additional 14 murders, bringing his total to 19 victims. He has not been convicted for every murder that he has confessed to because some of those cases were given a non-prosecution agreement. So basically they said, if you tell us the details, we won't prosecute you on this one. And so he would be like, all right. And so they were able to link him to a few more, but not prosecute him on it. Because in reality, he's never getting out of prison. He's there until he dies, which could be any day because he's not in great health. So, you know, let's get as many details as we can before he shuts down telling stories.
Makes sense.
He claims that his crimes started when he was a teenager and had victims across multiple states, including New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland, Florida, and Pennsylvania. He also claims that his victim count is near 100. Really? Cottingham is not in great health, but he is still alive and incarcerated where he will remain until he dies, which, like I said, could be any day. Out of respect for the victims, this is a list of his known murder victims. Marianne Carr, Valerie Street, Dee Dee Gordazzi, Mary Rayner, Mary De La Sala, Nancy Vogel, Jackie Harp, Irene Blaze, Denise Falasca, Lorraine Kelly, Mary Pryor, Diane Cusick, Mary Hines, Laverne Moy, Sheila Hyman, Marita Nieves, Lisa Thomas, Lorraine McGraw, and the unidentified victim from New York City that has been referred to as Manhattan Jane Doe. They still have not identified her.
Well, that was a fucked up story.
Yes. And it was so complicated. Like, I just like, because he would go, oh, well, then 1968, this happened. And then in 1972, this happened. And then 1960, I mean, they just linked all of these old things to him back and forth. But those are all just in New Jersey and New York. So if he was in other states that he claims, nothing in those other jurisdictions have been linked to him. So who knows?
That's fucking horrible.
It is super horrible. I'm glad that, you know, the other families have some resolution and they, you know, at least know who did it. And I don't know that it would matter after 50 years, but I guess, you know, it, I mean, I just don't know because I've never been in that position to have an opinion. I can't have an opinion on that, but I mean, resolution is always nice. And to know that he's sitting in prison and he's never getting out again. So there's that.
Yeah.
Do you have a chaser for us?
Yes, my chaser is an Instagram account, Derek Downey Jr. That's Derek with two R's. He has like pet squirrels. They're not like, they don't live at his house, but he has a house with a balcony and he's got a little house set up on his balcony. And he has like all the squirrels in his area named and he knows them and they like run up and play on his deck and go into their squirrel house.
That's adorable. It's really cool.
I like it.
That's so cute. He makes a bunch of like,
it's like a, not like a birdhouse or anything. It's like, it looks like a human house. It's almost like a dollhouse.
Oh, the for the little squirrels.
And he's got like a yard set up with a driveway and a mailbox and backstories behind all the squirrels.
That's so adorable. I'm going to have to check that out because, you know, I love squirrels. Love them. Yes. Love them. That is awesome. There's an actress. I don't know if you've ever seen her in anything. Her name's Angie Harmon, and she has a pet squirrel that lives in her house with her.
That's funny. That's kind of annoying, though. They probably try and get in your cabinets all the time and shit.
Oh, yeah. Like, she's got reels on Instagram because she posts all the time about this squirrel. I can't remember what the squirrel's name is, but he's, like, running over her head and down her shoulders and across her back and, like, getting into shit. She's always laughing about the crazy things that the squirrel is doing. And I love squirrels, but I wouldn't want one as a pet. Cause
me either.
No, it's a little too wild for me.
I'd rather have an otter.
Oh, absolutely. I'm signing up for an otter in a heartbeat. Your dad would murder me if I brought home an otter.
If you lived in Florida, that's what I should just get a big pool and let it swim around.
I should threaten him with bringing home an otter next time I want to get a dog or a cat. Be like, well, if you don't want me to have an otter, another cat couldn't hurt, right? I think he would catch on to that, though. So, my chaser is a throwback to one of our previous episodes just a few weeks ago. Do you remember the Mel's Hole episode where I talked about Devil's Hole? So Devil's Hole is that cavern in Nevada, and it's got that rare fish that lives in the water of it. And they're called the pupfish. And I think we talked about how the population of the pupfish was on decline. And they had, because it's an endangered species, it literally, that fish lives nowhere else. It is the only thing that lives in that hole, and that's the only place it lives. Well, I found an article recently that the population of the pupfish is on the rise, and for first time in 25 years, it's at a record high of over 200 fish.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, of course, they want to...
Is pufffish the species or just like the specific name of that fish?
No, it's a species of fish that only live in that hole. Okay. It's a little tiny blue fish that's like an inch to inch and a half long.
Yeah, I'm looking at them first time. They look pretty cool.
Yeah, they look kind of like a little guppy kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell from the picture just how big or small they are. But yeah, it would be an aquarium fish.
Super blue.
Yeah. So because they're on the rise and, you know, they're trying to figure out if they can do a little bit more research on them without endangering them further, because they, you know, they want to know about these fish. It's the only place that they live and they're super rare. And but now that they're on the rise to over 200 fish, maybe they can find out a little bit more about them.
Are there other fish in there? Or just
that
fish?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just that.
So they just eat each other? That's...
Yeah. Well, all fish eat each other.
Can't be that conductive to replication, but... Usually yeah, it's there's... eating another species fish, though.
Right. I don't know. You didn't do well with fish when we tried to have a fish tank for you. When I was a little kid, I had a fish tank with guppies in it, and I would get so excited when I had a pregnant guppy fish, and then I would get so bummed out when they would eat all of their babies and wouldn't have any baby fish left. I thought, oh my god, this is so gross. How are they eating all of their babies? But they did.
Yeah, it was pretty weird.
And I would always hope that the mama fish wasn't gonna deliver her babies while I was at school or something, because then I couldn't scoop her out before I got home to you to eat them all. There'd be like two little babies left and she's fat and happy because she just ate them all. Ugh, gross. Well, I think that wraps us up for our stories today.
I think you're right.
Thanks everyone for listening.
Yeah. I enjoyed hearing your story.
I sort of enjoyed hearing yours.
It was cool to learn about it.
Brought up a lot of questions about half man, half animals, and what orientation that half is in. Right, left, up, down, front, and back.
Right,
I think the
you.
Amalgamation part is probably the grossest option. I don't like that option
at
all.
Yeah, just different limbs and stuff. It's pretty gross.
No thanks. Like a Mr. Potato Head put together wrong.
Exactly.
Yuck. Ugh. All right. Love chatting with you, bud.
I love you too. Bye.
Bye. Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.